question here about time and subjectivity. There's been a discussion that time is subjective and has no real existence in the absolute. This would follow from what has been said about simultaneity in the absolute. Otherwise, the absolute would be subject to cyclic law and could not be eternal. Somebody's trying to trick me. Well, it's a long question, so I think we better examine it bit by bit. The statement here is time is subjective and has no real existence in the absolute. Well, we've said before that the word real is one of the most dangerous words in philosophy. Most philosophers use the word real, they bandy it about, and they never define it. So we'd better sort the word real out first. Are we going up or down tonight, Kevin?
Pulling it down.
We said that R and L, the determinants in the word real, signify differentiation and unification. We make a difference and then we band it together. Now, the real, therefore, means that which is differentiated and a unity at the same time. If we remember this, then we can say that wherever there is differentiation and unity, simultaneously there is reality. If ever you find unity going about without any differences in it, suspect it of being unreal. And if ever you find a lot of differentiated elements with no unity in them, report them to me. I'll have them arrested. If you think about it carefully, you'll find that when you're talking about differentiation, you're talking about small units which affect your sensorium in different ways. So if we had a unit triangle and a unit square, they would affect the eye differently. The difference is the meaning of this vibrating letter R. But each one would be a unity in its own right, and therefore there is an L in it. So, in order for it to be real, while it's being different, it must be itself a unity being different. And it can only be different from another unity. And if we take any unity whatever, we will always find that that unity, if it exists, differentiates itself from other unities in the process of being a specific unity. So if we take the unity of the square and the unity of the triangle, which the unity signifies the letter L, then we can see that we know square to be square is one of the things we can say we know it is not triangular. So the unity of square differentiates it from the unity of triangle. So where we have a unity, we have a differentiating factor from other unities. That is, where there is an L, there is necessarily an R. And where there is a difference, triangle and square, we necessarily have unity of the differentiating factors. So there is always unity and difference in unity in all existences. And this is what we mean by real. Now, supposing we examine the philosophical argument about whether the phenomenal world is real or not, we will find that the argument is nonsensical once we've accepted the definition of real that we've just given. The real is a difference in unity, or a unity implying a difference. Those people who have said that the phenomenal world is unreal have equated the word real with permanent. They have said, for instance, we take the Parmenidean sphere. The sphere of Parmenides is a sphere of form, a geometrical structure, finite for him, and internal to it all the forms of the universe. And there is nothing other than that for him, and it is eternal, it is permanent, it cannot change. once he has defined the real as that which cannot change, he made his first error. He produced a static sphere without noticing it. If he then says that the unchanging sphere of form is the real, then if somebody proves that change exists, he must shout out that is unreal. He's pretending that unity is the only thing present in his concept, and that difference, dynamic change, does not exist. Therefore, he's misusing the word real. He's saying the real is the unchanging. Now, some men went along the road and tripped over banana skins and things and fell over and bruised themselves, and then took their bruises to him and said, "We have changed. And because we have changed, there's something the matter with your universal concept." And in this way, scientific thinkers of the day contradicted his view that the world was static, that the world was permanently fixed in its form. If it had been fixed, then evolution would have been impossible, effort would have been a myth, and we would have had the problem of whether fantasy is real or not, because change was a fantasy to a person believing in this Parmenidean sphere. If we therefore say that the real is the unchanging, we have excluded from the real all change. So if I wave my hand, that is unreal by definition, because it's changing. So that definition of real will not do for our analysis. Whatever the real is, it must include change and non-change. Change is the letter R and non-change is the letter L. So the word real asserts two things simultaneously, change and non-change. Let's have a look for a moment and say, let L represent light and let R represent darkness. We'll put a big R in the middle of the word dark, and this is the L in light. Now, things that are separate in the world of tangibles, chairs that you can bang into in the dark, would be included under the letter R. But if we switch the light on, then all the things in the room start reflecting light and participate in the unity of light. So the differentiated elements at the tangible level, the separate chairs and tables, would then partake in a higher unity, the unity of visible light. If we said that separation was unreal, we would have deliberately finited our definitions down to the tangible level. We would have sent ourselves a piece of furniture as a circumscribed thing, and those things are essentially different and have no unity in them at all, that is no L function, then we're faced with the problem of their relation. Now that relation can only take place between bodies, and the betweenness is meaningless to those bodies if they are really separate. If we now tie them together, as if we're doing a letter L with its special fancy one, if you like, in the act of tying them together, we introduce a unity principle which includes them all. They retain their differences within the unity, and therefore we now have a concept of reality as we have defined it. Remember that when you are defining, we are not defining things. We can't repeat this too often, because there's a tremendous inertia in the mind to assume that we are defining things. We do not define things or ideas or emotions or anything whatever or any state whatever. We define the limits of the applications of terms. There are certain parts of this question that suggest that we should remind ourselves of that. We are defining the limits of the application of terms. Now, it says, time is subjective, and has no real existence in the absolute. We've said that time induces changes against a background. The changes would be the letter R, and the background against which they take place would be the letter L. If that is so, time is real. That is, it is a differentiation with a unity in it. In fact, we know this because when we experience time, we can only experience it if we have different moments and a continuity principle that ties the moments together in our memory. So that time includes differences, the different ideas, banana, sausage, cricket bat, and so on. And the fact that all these things have a certain form and relation, and therefore a continuity within my mind. My memory is the substance of my being, and the differentiations of that substance, serially presented, with the substance as background, constitute time. L is the background unity principle, my own substantial being, and the different ideas presenting themselves serially against that background constitute time. Supposing for a moment we remove consciousness, which is the spiritual substance behind all phenomena. We will pretend to remove it, actually we cannot. Because if we do, we will all promptly forget the whole subject. But let's pretend that we are so clever that we can actually remove the consciousness. We'll remove it from consideration while we consider it. What we then have left are a series of discrete ideas with no continuum to tie them together. And as there's no continuum to tie them together, they cannot be real. But we see immediately that these ideas cannot exist. If it exists, it must be real. When we have deliberately pretended that we can ignore consciousness, although we're using consciousness to ignore itself, we're indulging ourselves in a species of mental acrobatics, which is fundamentally illegitimate, which is dignified by the name of abstract thought, and is considered to be a very high kind of thought by intellectuals who have thereby deceived themselves for the last 6,000 years. Every time we pretend that we don't know something that we do know in order to clarify a situation, we rub out the link factors between things and then present ourselves with a relational problem. And the problem is insoluble because we've removed the link factor. And we've done it by the process called abstract thinking. And let's look at the word subjective for a moment. It says time is subjective. And there are two ways that we can use the word subjective. We are defining the limits of the applications of terms. So we're going to define the limit of the application of the term subjective. And we're going to define two limits. And one of them is that by subject we shall mean thrown underneath subject. And when we're talking about subjective, then we mean to say that the thing is conditioned from above. The thing, whatever it is subjected. But there is another use, a grammatical use of it, where subject means exactly the opposite. It means the being consciousness, the observer. So the first person singular in a sentence, I, means observer, this I. And we say that is the subject. I am a subject because I see. Now if you have the time and the energy to look in the dictionary, you'll find that the word sub means above and below. That S-U-B and S-U-P are the same root. So super and sub are exactly the same root. If you remember the diagram we did to show why this is so, a man can stand on the terrestrial globe and say that the earth is subject, thrown underneath him, Or he can say he is the subject who perceives the world. When he says the world is subject to him, his attention goes down. And when he says that the world is perceived by him as subject, you go up to him. So if we now take this line here, the circumscribing of the circle, and let that represent the letter B and the letter P, those labels, then we say subject when we are considering it as substantial, because B is pronounced with M on it, P you can whisper, B you cannot whisper. If you try to whisper a B, it simply becomes P. B, P, P, B. Make quite sure that you really believe that by trying to pronounce P with tone on it, and you'll find it's always B. And the Greeks sometimes represent the letter B with MP. But if you close your lips to say M and pile up the energy behind and let it blow out, it will sound B. So if we let this circumscription of the circle represent the letter B, it means we are considering it as a substance. But if we remove the substantial inertia of it, inertia means in working, the energy is working within it, which give it its inertia, its gyroscopic tendency to carry on being. We remove that concept, and then we call it, we should whisper it actually, in mantra yoga we mustn't voice a whispered vowel, otherwise we will deceive ourselves. We mustn't voice a whispered consonant. Pa. Now, imagine I say pa, so you can hear me, but I shouldn't say, I should whisper it. Pa. Now this pa is the positive limit considered without the substance. And as soon as we so consider it, we have actually indulged in a piece of abstract thinking. Because there is no positive being that does not immediately enclose energy within it. And that energy within it is its substance, its M. Nevertheless, we can consider the zone of an operation without considering the substance of an operation. For instance, if we get a piece of clay and model ourselves a little man, we can consider the substance of that man, or we can consider the form independently of the substance. It doesn't matter whether we make that shape in clay, plaster, stone, concrete, whatever. Its form is the same, and the whispered P is form, without substance. Whereas B, the being of it, implies substance. So, if we said subject or superject, it means above throne. If we say subject, it means under throne. But both these are the same root, as you will find in any good dictionary. Why it is used for above and below, they don't pretend to know. It's some queer way they had of thinking in the old days. But as soon as you remember the way they did think, where all the Greeks thought and the Romans borrowed it, and all the great thinkers of the ancient world thought geometrically, and therefore the same line circumscribing the zone could be considered as a B when you imagine the substance limited, or as P when you imagine it without the substance. Now the reason we can imagine it with substance is because we can actually pack more energy into a given zone than it had before we started. We can make it more substantial. We can blow air into a balloon and expand the balloon. Or we can blow the same amount of air into a balloon and put the balloon inside a steel case first so that it cannot expand. Now, the steel case is holding the balloon in, and there's the same amount of air in it that would have caused the balloon to become very big. Only the steel case is stopping it becoming very big, so we say there's more air inside the balloon than it was before we blew into it. There is therefore more substance in it. If we take the steel case off, the balloon will expand, cover a big area, and we will say it is less substantial than it was. So whenever we're thinking about a circumscribed zone as substantial, that is with the eminent, we must use a voiced vowel or consonant. Remember, you can divide the consonants and the vowels up into voice and unvoice. And when you use tone on it, you are implying substance in the thing. If we take the letter K, we can whisper it. Therefore, we can think about knocking without thinking about substance. We can think about attack without thinking about substance. But when we say the same sound exactly with the letter M added, it says ga. Now if you try to say ga, whisper, you will find that you will fail. The essential part about it is that you must start to pronounce tone by blocking the back of your mouth with your tongue and humming over it, and that's the M sound locked in, and then it will make g. That little bit of sound you hear before it turns k into g. Now we're defining the limits of the applications of terms, and if we remember that, we will not get into trouble with the things. I know we've said this before, and it might sound a bit laborious to repeat it. You can repeat it from now to the end of your life, and it won't do you any harm, because the whole of education is against doing this, and consequently, you are unconsciously defining things and defining ideas, or believing you are, and in actual fact, things are adequately defined already, ideas are already defined. Emotions and whatever other states there are what they are, quite independently of anything we say about them. So we cannot define ourselves anything whatever, or any state whatever. What we do is define the limits of the applications of terms. If we do this accurately, then we will discover that we can order ideas. K to gay, K in gay is the word king, and it means that the man who has got K, an intellectual proposition, and inserted it into a gross material situation, in other words, applied his knowledge in gross material act, he is a king. That's the only way we know a king, when we see a king, if he is a king, that he can actually put into the gross material world the formulations of his intellect. And that constitutes his kingship. So that when we're talking about time as subjective, we must be careful to see whether we mean that time is unreal by being subjective, or whether we mean that time is observed by an observing subject. Supposing we say, all the time we have ever seen, the form of the sentence, all the time we have ever seen, says that it is we who have seen this time. Now, we said that no being knows other than the modifications of its own substance. And therefore, if I have seen time, I have seen a modification of my substance. Now, my substance as a unity is L. And the time differentiations are R, so it must be real. Time is real. And it includes change and non-change within itself, because there must be an unchanging background against which the change occurs. If we then think that time is merely subjective in the sense, using B, subjective, thrown underneath the observer, we are not denying its reality, that is, that it has differences and similarities in it. We merely assert that it is itself caused by something above it. The statement time is subjective can mean that it is caused by something above it. It can mean that it is entirely an illusion. That somehow the observer sees things that are not there. Now, this is unclarity of thought, because we've already said that everything that we see, we see. If we see time, remember we are defining the limits of the application of the term time, we are seeing elements presented serially in consciousness. We have consciousness, L, the link factor, and elements presented serially. Then the structure of time and observer constitutes reality. If we remove the observer, the L factor, the thing falls to bits. And it isn't time anymore. See, the whole problem of dealing with time and the failure of philosophy to solve it is because they will separate time from the observer, believing that if they leave the observer in, they have made it subjective. You see? Believing that if they leave the observer in, it has become subjective. But take the observer out, which you cannot do, but you can pretend that you can, and you remove not only time, but every other concept to which you could apply the term real. Now, we can see here this very ticklish little problem. If consciousness has within it serial presentation of forms, and serial presentation of forms within consciousness constitutes time, and that it's illegitimate abstract thinking to take either the consciousness and throw that away and pretend that it isn't there, or to posit the consciousness there without having the serial elements presented within it, in which case we wouldn't be talking at all, because our speech is already serial presentation within consciousness. If we do either of those things, we are illegitimately abstracting and deliberately pulling wool over our own eyes. You see, we deliberately pretend that we can do things that we can't do, and we justify it by calling it abstract thought. Abstract thought overthrew the Greeks. Abstract thought overthrew the Babylonians, the Egyptians, the Indians, the Romans. Abstract thought will overthrow everybody, because it pretends that you can throw away either the consciousness or the fact, forgetting that by the rule that any being knows only the modifications of its own substance, and its own substance is consciousness itself. Spirit is sentience. Then in throwing away one of those, he is not actually doing what he says he is doing. He's illegitimately using terms. He's saying, I will throw something away, but he doesn't throw it away. He says, I won't mention it anymore. And in not mentioning it, pretend that it isn't there, but it is there. Time is subjective, therefore, we can say, could have two meanings, that time is subjected to something above itself, and that which is above itself must be that which transcends our help. And when we see this fact, if there is difference and there is unity, because difference and unity are different, there must be something behind both, which is neither different nor the same. Now, when some of the geometrical thinkers said it is not the same, it isn't different, or it is different and the same simultaneously, then people thought they were talking a bit crazily, and said they were indulging in abstract thought. They were. They were indulging in concrete thought. They were putting R and L together and asserting difference and identity simultaneously of that which lies behind both. If we get a rope and wiggle it, the wiggles are not the rope, but the rope is wiggling. You can't take the wiggles off the rope. You can have the rope without the wiggles if you want, because you can pull the rope straight. This is what we mean by saying that the rope is a substantial reality, but the ripples are only phenomenal. And yet, funnily enough, the fact that that rope exists, if it is an existential rope we're talking about, on analysis will break down into very, very tiny ripples. The fact that we can make a big ripple on the rope means really the rope is made of lots of little ripples. Now that existential rope is only an illustration of something, and our consciousness has been directed to a non-rope, to a unity principle. We've used the idea of rope as a unity principle, and on it the ripples as differentiation, and yet the rope, if it exists, is differentiated from other beings, non-ropes. So when we use such a concept to induce the contemplation of unity and difference simultaneously, we are not to be trapped into thinking that the universal absolute is like a piece of rope. It is much like a can of sardines. And I mean that literally, in the sense of the packing of forms within an enclosure. Every time we take out a portion of reality and use it as an illustration for the absolute, we are helping ourselves if we remind ourselves to see that it is merely one figure of speech. And we could take a million figures of speech to express exactly the same thing. When Christ was talking to farmers, he used the image that farmers use. When he was talking to fishermen, he talked about fish. Whatever person he was talking to, he used the terminology acceptable to that person. But he was always talking about the same thing. Like Socrates was always talking about the same thing. So behind all illustrations, we have to see that which binds together all the things without reducing them to a unity without difference. So we have to take all conceivable differences and tie them all together in a unity which does not destroy their differences. And this idea that different elements, when added together, produce a unity which is merely the totality of the parts, is not true. When we add together various elements, if they manage to stay together, there's a principle there, other than their separate bodies, that binds them. The Germans use the word Gestalt for this. The thing is standing and tied together, and there is a unity principle linking these separate factors. A human being is a number of organs, a number of cells. But if you distribute all those cells by throwing a hand grenade over a field, it isn't a human being anymore. You've blown apart that tension that kept them together, and now it's lost its essential characteristic as human. And we said that time was an emission of energy. It's something to do with the emission of energy. Behind R and L, the differentiating factor, is the non-dual absolute. We say it's non-dual, because if we said it was monistic in structure, we would have to say that R could be explained in terms of L, or L explained in terms of R. That is to say, we'd have to get rid of one of the terms and hide it in the other one. Let's try this as an illustration. Suppose we write the letter R and put L inside it. In so doing, we see that the L has been enclosed only by the round part of the R, and the part of the R, like the letter V, sticks below it. And it still means differentiation outside the L. We haven't actually managed to enclose that L in such a way that it covers exactly all the R. So there will then be something differentiating outside the field of unity. And that something would not constitute the real, because we've already said the real includes both. So if we like to talk about Ahasuerus as an energy wandering outside circumscription, that is unreal. It is only half real, because it's only rrr outside here, and there's the tie, circle with the L in mouth, the circle, which is the L function. When we think about time as moments, as changes in consciousness presented seriously, and we know that every element in consciousness is no more than an energy impulse or impulse complex. Then we take the whole field of consciousness. Remember that consciousness is itself, its own power of motion. It is not static. Within itself, it produces condensations of itself. We mark those with Saturn. Those condensations are zones of contraction or concentration. And it presses the energy in and keeps packing it in, substantializing it, until there's too much in it and it flirts out and posits another point. Now, it is this packing in to the point of it flirting out and positing another point and repeating that constitutes the time process. It is an emission of energy within consciousness. Consciousness, the absolute field, any rotation within it, packed, super packed with energy, flirts some of the energy out beyond its perimeter and posits a new center, which immediately then starts drawing in energy and posits again. Now we can see that time in this sense is real. Here's our differentiation factor, the circumscribed zone, and here's the link factor. The energy turned in squirts out, posits another center, and there's a continuous link. Now time, we saw before, had me in it and it. Now me is the objective form, grammatically, of the observer. I, subject, me, the object. If I think of me, I am thinking of a consciousness objectified. If I think of it, I deliberately abstract the concept of consciousness from the me. I take any object at all, deliberately ignore the consciousness in that zone, and there is consciousness in every zone. I deliberately ignore it and call it it. Or I take any it and I deliberately postulate that there is consciousness in it, identify with it and call it me. Now that is like the ball of the eye. If we complete the drawing of the eye, then the eye is actually a larger concept than the me, because the me is posited as an object within the eye. The absolute infinite consciousness posits an I, that is a sphere, and that is me at that point. Me means substantial. That, incidentally, that E there is an H form of a soft order in primitive languages. So that MH is me, M with H in it, and that H means the consciousness, spirit itself. You'll notice in the drawing of an Egyptian eye that there's a long curve on it, like that, in the symbol of the eye. This curve is simply to remind you of the spiral generation of the me, the object. Now, we know that there is biological time, in the sense that if we take a seed and plant it in the ground, energies from the sun come into it, water goes into it from the earth, it expands, certain changes occur, and then a shoot comes out of it. Now, if you get an ultra-rapid camera, you can see that all the growth of these plants takes place impulsively, not continuously. They jump, they grow in little jerks. Definite energy quanta come in, and pack inside, and then flirt out. It'll grow up to a certain length, and if you watch with ultra-rapid camera work, you will find it will tremble at a certain point, and then there'll be a sudden flick, a new shoot, and the energy grows along to the end. Right at the tip you'll see another tremble, then a new shoot. Now this is biological time, and there is at the moment a battle going on about biological time and what they call ordinary time, without defining ordinary. And a suggestion there might be two times. And you know Dunn's work on the serial universe, posits a whole series of times, one behind the other. If we allow that time is an emission of energy, objectifying and thus creating a me for an observer, and the whole process is real, then time could only be abstract if you ignored some of the essential relating factors. If you took out the me and ignored the I. If you took out the energy that jumped and ignored from what it jumped and to what it jumped. That time is subjective, has no real existence in the absolute. We see now that because time is subjective, it is real. Now, if you read the existentialists, of whom probably the best is Kierkegaard, and if you want a bit of Germanic thought, Heidegger, you will find that subjectivity is dealt with adequately in their works as the only base of any statement whatever. But this you must know, because no being knows other than the modifications of its own substance, nor can it. And as the subject here means the observer, what the observer observes is always internal to the observer's consciousness. And in that sense, all things are subjective. Now, this subject is intelligent spirit, and as soon as it begins to define, that is to take its absoluteness and turn it, it has made itself an object, and the object it has made is a me. That is to say, it is itself objectified. This is why, if you concentrate on the me part of yourself, your substantial physical being, in the fact that you do concentrate on it at all, you exclude from your heightened awareness another me formulated in exactly the same infinite field. You have tied yourself to a me, to an object, to a substantial being. If we take the materialist, he doesn't know anything at all about this absolute inwinding, so he posits atoms. He's anachronistic to do it, but he still does. If there is a me there and a me there and nothing between, then no relation whatever is possible. So to posit even simultaneity in those two would be to introduce illegitimately a third something that could relate both to itself. Supposing we posited another being, and this other being were equally isolated as the first two. A and B are presented to C. How are they presented? In the diagram we've drawn lines to show them presenting themselves, and the lines have gone across space. Those lines either represent forces, in which case space is no longer empty, or they represent nothing, in which case there is no communication. Absolute subjectivity simply means that the infinite consciousness is the cause and background of all objectifications. The absolute posits simultaneously all over itself centers. It posits them simultaneously. Viewed as simultaneously posited by the absolute, there is no serial presentation for it. But where there is identification with a given objectification, then is the possibility of serial perception of others. Now, most people think of time in terms of motion of fingers around a flat face. Some philosophers think that time is power moving, power emitting itself. This can only occur within an infinite field, and that field must include the philosopher's mind within it as an impulse device. The philosopher's mind is any kind of machine that keeps coming to conclusions. That is to say, he comes to definitions. And if the definitions manage to cohere, then he calls it a good system. And if the definitions keep falling apart, he calls it a bad system. And yet all the philosophical systems that have ever been made to the satisfaction of a philosopher have subsequently been proved fallacious by another philosopher. Because they all start from an arbitrary base, namely the me with which they are identified in the first place. And if you identify with the absolute instead of with the me, you transcend philosophy. Because by the word philosophy, as we said, the first letter in philosophy, phi, means analysis, means severance. First you circumscribe, then you sever. And that's the basis of philosophy. So the absolute transcends philosophy as such. We don't seem to be getting on very fast with this question. The problem that time has no real existence if all forms are presented simultaneously within the absolute. Because although they're presented to the absolute as simultaneous, they are presented to the finite rotations serially. So the time is then included as a modal operation within eternity, but as our word real means differentiating and unifying, it is real. This is like a reel of cinema pictures, if you like, where again you have the differentiating factor. Each picture is slightly different from the others, and the unifying factor that the forms of those things remain the same and are backed by the film, which gives them continuity. It was a good observation to say otherwise the absolute would be subject to cyclic law and could not be eternal, but in fact, if we posit a cycle, and this cycle is never destroyed, that would be an eternal cycle. Unless we define the word eternal very, very carefully, we could write the word eternal like this, with a unit if we wanted to, and then we could say that as E equals spirit, and the term, and the activity and tying together of it, would constitute the eternal circle. When Nietzsche and other philosophers are talking about the eternal recurrence, they have been triggered into imagining a cycle of activities in this sense, a closed system. But if we take the infinite as the eternal, we take the U out of the turn and put an E in it, because that E is a soft aspirate in the early languages. It's been altered to an E in the fifth letter of our alphabet. Eternal then means that there is spirit differentiating and crossing itself, tying itself together, and although all cycles are included within it, itself is not a cycle. The infinite, obviously, not being finite, it cannot be a cycle in the sense in which we can draw a circle, but simply because whatever it is, whatever the word is means, it can never cease to be that which is signified by is. Therefore, it is loosely said to be eternal in the sense of cyclic. Now, a finite circle would be held, it would be held in, it would bind, circumscribe, and hold what is called in the Bible roughly forever, although it says from the ages to the ages, or from the age to the age. And the word ever, as we've said before, is a good French word for dream, reversed, and it only means for the period of a dream or for the period of a formal presentation cycle. A cycle is necessarily finite, but the infinite contains within itself an infinity of cycles. So we do not have to say the absolute would be subject to cyclic law and could not be eternal, because again the word subject has been introduced, and the absolute is the subject in the sense of the absolute intelligence. The absolute is not thrown under the cyclic law and cannot be, because cyclic is essentially finite, and there is always beyond the finite cycle the absolute as non-circumscribed, and yet that absolute is the subject, grammatically, the seer of the cycle. So that cycle is subjective, that is, it is seen by the infinite, and yet the infinite is not subjected or thrown under to the cycle. See how tremendously important these words are, particularly words like subjective and objective and so on. Almost the only constant in modern physics is the speed of light, and yet there is a contradiction of quantum and wave theories. If the laws of conservation of energy and matter are true, the only thing time can destroy is form. Yet form is only a stress in an ever-present space-time continuum, and what is can never cease to be. Now, this statement, really, we've dealt with before on other levels. Let's take the part, the only thing time can destroy is form. When we said that time is a process of differentiating, tied into a unity, and that it produces cycles, packs energy into them, and then jumps out of that cycle and posits another, and so serially presented. Then, to talk about time destroying form, is simply to say, first it posits one form, and then jumps out of that form and posits another. Now this is the same thing as the mythic statement Kronos first creates children and then devours them. So that when we posit a form, that is energy, it will run for a time, a cycle, a period. We pack in energy to it and some energy jumps out. Now when the energy jumps out, we can say the interest has gone with it. It now posits another form here. This first form then begins to die, because it's no longer a point of reference for the evolving spirit. The infinite now, we would say, puts its energy into this one, into B instead of A. A then begins to diminish, and the energy that was put into it begins to soak back into the infinite, and it is as if the infinite were eating it again. So there is a positing of energy for a time, that is for a period, for a time yet, and there is investigation of the formal possibilities within that to the point of view of exhaustion of that interest, during which time energy is being packed in. And when the interest is exhausted, then the energy leaps out and posits a new center. And it transcends the old form, posits a new one, and then the new energy from the infinite coming in goes into the second form, ignores the first, and the first begins to fade. Now you'll find here, and if we don't examine it carefully, we will begin to think that the past ceases to be. That there is a strange phenomenon of memory. Somehow, although the energy is taken out of that, in the gross world, the memory of it is not taken out. And this argues that at another level, all the form that is involved into the time process pre-existed its serial presentation. We come back again to the idea of the eternality of form. If we remember the fact that we've stated before, if we insert energy into a closed system, we have necessarily inserted form. The energy inserted into a closed system must run about within that system and begin to organize it. Now, energy, therefore, is a formative something. It's not just force, it is formal force. If we take the illustration of the smallest thing was, say, an atom. And imagine that atom being bombarded by a force from outside. So the force goes into the atom and becomes involved in the atom so that the atom expands. The orbits of its electrons may increase or something like that. For a definite amount of energy going in, there is a definite form of change. It can't produce no effect. It must produce some effect. And the effect, the X-fact, that manifests is always a form of change. Time, then, can be said to destroy form. But there is nothing in the whole universe manifest other than form. So in destroying form, it is destroying all that is. Now, we can't pronounce the letter M without closing our lips. And therefore it signifies finiting. So when we talk about form, we're talking about finiting, substantiating, of that signified by for. And that for, or fire, or pyre, it's all the same concept, simply means rotation. You posit and then substantialize, and rotation encloses a zone of energy, and the energy inside that zone is not static, it goes around, spins about, hums, and substantializes, systematizes itself, and that is form. As time is the whole process here, there is an involvement and a formulation, substantialization, and when the concentrated energy there has subserved its purpose of interest, when we have gone inside it and exhausted its meaning, then we let go of it. But it doesn't cease. I can't use the word be because I'd have to whisper it. It doesn't cease absolutely. The energy then returns to its previous state of expansion. It's still exactly formally what it was when it was made gross. Only now the same amount of energy that constitutes the physical gross body has been played out over a larger area and has therefore become non-existent for a gross level being. If we postulate our infinity to be full of the circles that we've drawn so often, each one of which has its own centre, a centre of generative impulse, we can see that the generation of a gross material is simply the contraction of the energy of one of those circles onto itself, and it is self-contracting. And it contracts itself for a purpose, and when it has fulfilled that purpose, it lets go and returns to its previous level. So the gross time process can then be seen as a function of an eternal form. When Christ says every man goes into his own place, he means that this gross material compact me that everybody has, after the purpose has been fulfilled, that amount of energy will return and occupy its larger circle. It will still be formally what it was, but it will not be tangible, it will not be packed at the gross level. When it gets packed at the gross level, it develops inertia. When it is at its proper extension, it has no inertia and is pure initiative. If we expand consciousness away from the body, away from the gross body, stretch it out, feel outwards, include all the room, and then the house, and then the city, and then the world, and so on. In the act of expanding it, you are returning the form of that body back to its infinite source. When you concentrate again onto your physical body, you're pulling in the act of concentrating, consciousness, power, and so on, packing it into the body, and the body will then begin to act impulsively by that concentrated energy, and it will run about, and it will start positing things, or interfering with other bodies. In fact, the more you concentrate on the physical body as such, the more it will interfere with other physical bodies, simply from an energy point of view. If you then extend the consciousness the other way, it won't interfere with other bodies, because it will include them.
The word duration gives you that rotation of God again.
Yes, the D-U-R is the same as the T-U-R, only that the D is voiced and the T is not. Therefore, duration implies sentence, whereas duration doesn't. This translating energy, should it be subject to time? Again, this depends on the meaning of the word subject. As consciousness itself is absolutely the only substance there is and is itself the subject, then it is the subject internal to which time is precipitated. And it is subjected to time because time is the way it behaves. It is subjected to its own behavior. So the subject, the observer, when he posits a me, a substantial being, within himself, watches it, that is, he is a subject, but he also identifies with it in bringing it to be, and is therefore subjected to the kind of behavior that he initiates in it. As he sows, so he reaps. To sow is to posit that seed form. And then you identify with it and you reap the result of having identified with that form rather than another. The end of this, is it possible to relate time, light and sound as modalities of spirit? Shortly we can say yes. We can relate all existential facts together, whatever, assuming we have sufficient time. And as time is emission of energy, sufficient energy. Remember that spirit itself, as the word tells you, the S is a translating force there, P is the positing of it, I is the centre of that positing, P goes like that and now puts a dot in the middle, R is the differentiating through that point, and I following the R is the other points that arise, S, P, I, R, posits lots of little eyes. Each little eye is then crucified within the whole. Now that is spirit. The word spirit then tells you the whole process. That the infinite, S, posits the macrocosmos, the macrocosmic eye, vibrates that, transmits from that energy to the perimeter, it returns back onto the center. It breaks up the whole zone into lots of little dots, the eye following the arm. Each one of those is pinned on the intersection waves of all the others, and that's T. So the word spirit contains the whole process from beginning to end. Let's just say one or two more things about words and defining. When we're dealing with the word, we are dealing usually with a highly complex structure. To define a word like spirit, we have to define S in terms of another word, which has parts. And we have to define P in the same way, and so on with the other letters. Now, if we keep defining every simple letter with a word that contains a lot of letters, what we are actually doing is expanding our consciousness. We are releasing ourselves from an idea that the word spirit has a particular significance, like a sheep walking about with nobody under it in the middle of the night, and so on. We have to break the tyranny of objectification of the mind. The mind is spirit viewed as evaluator, as machine. and its tendency, because it is moving, is continuously to precipitate within itself form. And when it precipitates a form, it has an object of consciousness. And as soon as it sees it, it either likes it or dislikes it. If it likes it, it starts packing more energy into it. If it dislikes it, it pushes it away. You can feel this going on inside yourself. Supposing it likes it, then it bolsters it up with all the forms related to it that it can find. And that concept then grows bigger and bigger and bigger and pushes out other ones which are vibrating around it. It then dominates the field of consciousness. Now this domination is an act of will. It is an act of will for each of us if we say, I will think about this body as central to consciousness rather than other bodies in the room. Any consciousness in the room can think about any body in the room as central and concentrate upon it and thus become the governing consciousness of that body. If you concentrate on the cat's ear as a sensitive organ and the ear flickers, and you find that you can do this deliberately, it means that consciousness has been directed by consciousness, of which you have become yourself conscious, in a body other than the one you normally work with. There's nothing to stop consciousness working in any body or any number of bodies simultaneously. It is already doing it. But whenever there's a particular activity of a certain intensity in a gross material body, it simply means that energy has been contracted into that zone and is still being pulled in order to step up the activity of that vehicle higher than the surrounding ones. This means that if you let go of the constituent vibrations of your own egoic consciousness, let them float out, you won't lose, you will gain. What you had hold of then will be spread over a larger area, and that larger area will include within itself things that previously you thought belonged to other bodies. If you identify with the absolute, you can really simply say, all bodies are mine. And by that you mean they are countable in consciousness. When Christ says, those the Father puts into my hand, no man shall snatch out. He's identifying with this absolute energy, seeing every little being within it as no more than a modality of it, and knowing that because he, the Father Spirit, has organized a particular vehicle, we call here the Jesus vehicle, till it can reflectively become aware of its origin, and therefore stops the gross contingent attack on other beings externally, and thus stops the reaction which keeps him grossly conscious, then his consciousness spreads and includes all those other beings. Thus he becomes all things to all men. He can only do that by so organizing his own vehicle that he has a one-for-one correspondence between the parts of that vehicle and all the other vehicles in the world. For instance, Christ understood what sin was. Now you can only understand a thing by seeing a modification of your own substance, which meant to say that he knew what sin was internally. When he was in Gethsemane arguing the case with himself about whether to sacrifice or not, he knew what sin was, otherwise he couldn't have been tempted. When the devil is represented as putting him on a high place and offering him world dominion, he knew what sin was. And so he has inside himself an impulse to dominate the world, an impulse to dodge crucifixion. He conquers these impulses and therefore constitutes himself Christ. Blessed is he who overcomes. And once he's done that, he has inside himself a great mass of conquered sins. Now these conquered sins keep him in resonance with all the sins outside which are embodied in other people. If you look in the Old Testament, you'll find it doesn't describe Christ as looking like an Italian pretty boy. Christ, as defined in the Old Testament, is a misshapen figure. So awkward to look at that he's automatically despised and rejected of men because of his physical appearance alone. Which means to say that there are evidences upon him, as on Socrates, of all things that from the outside will be said to be embodied sins. Now, sentimental thinkers don't like to think for a moment that their Messiah had sin in him, although they don't mind him taking it on him, like a navvy's red spotted handkerchief on the end of a stick. They don't like it in his substance. They don't like him bearing it inside himself, because they're not sure that they would like to sit next to a tramp on a bench in the park. This sentimentality stops from understanding what he did. From 12 to 30, he went about studying sins and watching his internal reaction and being against those sins and opposing all the sins in opposites throughout his being, so that they were all balanced against each other. Because the funny thing about sins is they're all in pairs of opposites, and you can't do them both simultaneously. So if you've got a very clear sight, you'll be able to stop a sin by finding the opposite sin and making it just as intense. Like sadism and masochism, you can't do both of them. Now, when this process of involvement of spirit into a being occurs, because spirit is infinite, it is in no place other than itself. So wherever it posits at all, it posits itself absolutely. This is the meaning of the seamless garment. It doesn't posit the nice bit with the clean hands and clean neck. It posits itself wholly. And therefore it says in the book that when God gives, he gives himself without measure. So when the spirit posits in a zone, it's posited in that zone the same that it's posited in that zone. And if in that zone there it can sin in that zone. If it doesn't sin in this zone and it does in that, that only means that in this place it has gone through those internal motions of balancing all of the sins. And if it does sin in this place, it means that it didn't get to that point and was disequilibrated by an external stimulus. It's essential to see this, that spirit itself, even the very name tells you, in this part here, that it has inside itself all that which, taken out, serialized, and disequilibrated, constitutes sin. Here we have a differentiation factor, the very ground of intellectual separative judgment, and therefore the very beginning of pride. There is pre, there is I, and there is an unvoiced deed. So we have pride in spirit. All we need to do is close the lips to turn T into D. You put M on T and it voices and becomes D, and then we've probably got spirit. We've now got a substantiated thing concentrated on a finite, and as soon as it concentrates on a finite, to the exclusion of others, that is pride, but it's no more than one of the potentialities of the absolute. Again, sentimental thinking doesn't like the absolute to be capable of these things. But the absolute is absolute power. It can do all these things. A few weeks ago, in a discussion with a man, when I said to him, "Am I not he who gives good and gives evil, saith the Lord?" he demanded to know the reference. From a concordance, I got a friend of mine to compile about 40 references of equivalent significance. when God gives evil to a being, he doesn't give good to a being, he gives evil to a being. If a being behaves very badly, say like the Egyptians during the Mosaic occupation in Egypt, if he kills all the firstborn, well, it's an evil to kill all the firstborn. But those killed entities are entities which in themselves, if they had not been eliminated, would have been very, very busy eliminating some others that the spirit is more concerned with. Spirit is not namby-pamby. It's not nothing. And Christ is not an Italianate pretty boy. He was spirit with all its actuality, because spirit is not potential, it is pure actuality, established on the gross world, and in coming into contingent relation, coming into sin, and taking sin upon his shoulders means that the infinite took finity upon himself, and thus exposed himself by becoming finite to the possibility of temptation, that is, of energy emission of a serial order. And internal to himself, he has to balance the power within against the power of the external stimulus. The power of the external stimulus is the devil. It is that external stimulus that says, as you know all about spirit, you could dominate the world. He could. He knows all the tricks. He says, I've not come to dominate the gross world. I've come to make people in the gross world realize that finity and separateness is falsity, and that really they belong in another world, the infinite. Now, the amount of stimulation his gross body had to try to persuade him to act contingently was terrific. And the more he exposed himself to the attacks of rabbis and other funny fellows, then the greater the internal motion must have become. Now, internal motion inside a being, coming from outside at a very, very great rate, can cause internal confusion. If you try to listen to, say, five different symphonies by different composers on five gramophones simultaneously, you will find it quite difficult to follow the theme. And that is nothing compared with being assailed by stimuli of a biological order, by Mary Magdalena and various other creatures, and by rabbis trying to crucify you all at once, and to balance all these things and to reject absolutely the desire for dominion contingently on the gross material level. As soon as he has rejected that absolutely, then all the energies in here respond absolutely to the spirit. Just bringing the roll down. And the result is a conversion of the energies of the gross level, change of phase, increase of frequency, and the broadcasting throughout the universe of the motion from that body. That body then becomes a unique center, broadcasting high frequency energy throughout all universal space. That energy acts on the harmonic principle on the lower frequencies of these other beings and inserts into them the awareness of cosmic logos, which makes them, whenever they do anything naughty at the contingent level, feel uncomfortable, twinges of conscience and so on. So he actually determines the mental processes of all other beings at the point when he has conquered this reaction to the contingent relation.
He becomes a dominant at that point, which is what he said he wasn't meant for, that he wouldn't accept.
Well, he rejected the dominance on the gross material level, he still rejects it. His dominance is from here, through the field. It's true that he determines them grossly, but not by contingent attack. It is an inversion, because he does actually dominate, but he isn't doing something he said he wouldn't do. Because all he said he wouldn't do was dominate them on the gross material level. He dominates them on the other level, and that makes them feel uncomfortable. And then they have to modify their gross material behaviour to correspond. So he's not worked a fast one across the room. When we try to define a word with more than one letter in it, we have to use a lot of words. Suppose we try to define a word with only one letter in it, a certain letter A. That's the indefinite article. It's equivalent to one. In person, we would say, one does this, one does that, or a man does this, a man does that. But this letter A is before B, and therefore signifies the uncircumscribed, whereas the O actually signifies circumscription. This A corresponds with Aleph. It means any being, whatever. Now, beyond the biggest circumscription there is, which is the biggest B there is A. Can we define A? No. Can we define the use of the letter A? Yes. We will use the letter A now to mean not the indefinite article grammatically, but that energy which, being transcendent of all boundaries whatever, is called absolute. So the A equals absolute. Instead of then defining all the letters of the word absolute, we simply remember how we have decided to use the letter A, meaning that which transcends absolutely all finite in circumscribing activities. Now let's go and look at the word absolute in relation to it. The first letter is A, which signifies transcendence of all finite. The next one is B, which signifies all finites that can be transcended. The next one signifies the spirit which has gone from the A through the wall of the B and appears inside as an organizing function. It's gone inside the O. When it's gone inside the O, it ties it all together and makes a unity principle within it. Now, it drives itself along the primary oom, and it fixes a form of itself in its goings along. And it breathes, that's that gentle H, throughout itself and throughout the R, which is beyond the B. So again, the absolute, the word absolute, contains within itself certain symbols which express the whole relation of spirit from another point of view. The Ab, Hebrew for father, saw the sun, and the cell could have been doubled because the mute is the instrument, or vibrating energies from the sun and the father, which causes the manifestation of the power of the father and the sun. So the absolute itself means Father, the Son, and Holy Spirit. This unit itself alone means that the power is self-formulated. When we look at the word spirit, instead of absolute, we are taking the S here and the P and the E, spirit, as belonging to the Ab, because he's pulsing a point, and the R belongs to the sun as Rex, the king, and the It is the universal form which is pulsed by those two. So all we're doing is shifting the frame of reference. In the word spirit, we're more concerned with the formal activities of it as differentiating functions. In the word absolute, we're concerned with its whole flow of energy, rather than the individuation, differentiation process we see in spirit. So, it would be a good idea if in formulating questions. When a sentence occurs in the mind to constitute a question, there's something like the one about the statement that there isn't a statement. When it occurs, try to define every word in the sentence. Not just the sentence. That is, try to determine the limits of the application of every word in the sentence. If that can be done, the question will grow very long and turn into a thesis. But in the process, it will turn itself out. The implications of the terms will explicate themselves, and you will discover that the question you have posited has answered itself in the process of defining the terms of the question. This is why a good English archbishop said, logic is the explication of the implication of terms. When you feel inside yourself that a question could be found, it really means that form, at a very fine level, has started to press in, and you feel it beginning to press in. Now the form of the question and the answer to that question are already extended throughout infinity. When your organism, through any situational stimulus whatever, begins to vibrate in a new way, then by resonance you become aware of what you call a question. I on a quest. You are going, questing, looking for a particular, which you call the solution. The whole field of form presses in on you, and at a certain level you are aware that a question can be found. If you think about it, concentrate on it, gradually it comes in more and more, and then you find the question. Now, if you throw the question out at that level to another person, then the internal work that you might have done can't be done. Not in the same way. But if you take the question and beat it in harder and harder and harder, doesn't you get the zone of the question? Energies are pressing in, and you beat them in harder and harder, and the question begins to formulate, say, as 20 words. You begin to define each word. There's a definition of that word. But in defining that word, you have used other words. There's the definition of that word, and that word, and that word. As you define each word, you posit another circle. Gradually you fill in the zone of this concept, which started the question. Drive yourself to define the term and the term and the term that define the term, and just keep at it. Force yourself through the definition. At a certain point, you will feel terribly blocked. And when you do, try to force yourself to define further until you are really tired. And as soon as you've done that, let go of it. Chop it. Refuse to consider it anymore. You have now packed the zone in here. But the forms have been presented serially in defining serially. Therefore, they're not in the right order. But they are packed. You then leave it alone, refuse to look at it. And it has inherent in itself an orderly structure, a relationship between the forms. So that when you let go of it and don't look at it again, because you're not interfering with it serially, it vibrates internal to itself, and all the forms shape themselves free from non-essential contingent contact. And thus gradually, the forms within that defined zone find their own positions. They can't find it while you're serializing. They must find it if you stop serializing. So when you do get a question, work on it very, very hard in that way. If you do get stuck, of course, completely, then a question will be popped out. It will come up. But if you are able to inhibit it and keep it in this way, you will find the resolution in yourself. Any human being, or any being whatever, if it were to drive itself to define the question that it has posited, and define all the terms that it uses to define its first term, and define all those terms, will block the zone with form. And when it has been done serially, if it is then stopped, and the mind refuses to consider it, leaving it, it vibrates itself into position. And then suddenly, the thing is seen for what it is, the complex rational structure, all the parts of which fit each other so well, that it suddenly regains the original unity it had before you serialized it.